Hey, everybody, it's Adam Ray and Brad Williams for the About Last Night podcast. Another special episode.
We're touring now, essentially, with this. We're going into people's homes.
Yeah, we're
invading them.
Two for two on going into big comedians' homes and interviewing them. And I think, today's episode is, shit, man, it's super incredible to me because we interviewed a guy who is responsible for me seeing stand-up as something that was both intimidating and inspiring, but I saw him do it so incredibly and so masterfully that I was like, yeah. I want to do what he's doing. And that guy is none other than Carrot Top. No, it's it's Dane Cook.
Dane Cook, everyone. Arguably the biggest star in stand-up over the last 10 years. No, you know what?
One of six comedians to sell out Madison Square Gardens.
Multiple arenas. Across the country, just a huge star once again, invite us into his home. And we never really have intentions about what we want to do with the podcast. We kind of prep a little bit, but yeah. We never know exactly where it's going
to
go.
We have a map of like what we want to ask people. We wanted to
get, and
we definitely did. We got into his beginnings in stand-up, hosting SNL.
Some incredible Saturday Night Live stories.
Incredible. His whole rise during that time of gaining fans and going into clubs and being the new guy and what that was like versus now where he's been around and he talks about the very candidly the break he took because of some of the shit he went through with his had to put his brother in jail and his folks dying within 6 months of each other and not really hadn't up until that point experienced grief and loss like that and how it shaped him and how who he is today and how E.T. inspired him to get into fucking show business.
Which is an incredible story.
So he said he's never told.
Yeah, he wasn't planning on telling that, and then we sort of walked in, we described the Hollywood Hills and off we went.
Sure.
And a comic through his use of social media has taught...
Changed the game.
Yeah, has taught all comics how to use social media in terms of how to get yourself out there, get your fan base together. So every comic owes this guy something.
And you know what? All the bullshit and hate that he experienced is just, you know, par for the course of someone who got as big as you could possibly get. And hey, man, again, another person that we've had minimal conversations with both at comedy clubs and gotten more chummy. And like I said, man, to be on shows with him now is like a fucking huge honor. And sort of then be in his home and be interviewing him on our show. And I feel like now, I mean, again, you really get to know somebody through doing this show, man. It's one of the perks for us that to now become, I feel like, shit again. That like,
it is really cool that we do get to meet our heroes and not just meet them and have the normal, hey, how are you? Nice to meet you. Pleasure to meet you. Whatever. We are getting to know people. Yeah. And I think we really got to know Dane within this conversation. And I think he got to know us a little bit. And we had a great time doing it. So.
Show runs about an hour 30.
Yeah.
But you know what?
Worth it.
Yeah. I would not go to the Olive Garden over this.
Well,
an hour 30 is about the appropriate time to spend at the Olive Garden, too.
Well, now we're going to lose them as a sponsor. I have to go back to Chili's. Son of a bitch.
But Dane brought it on this episode. It's by far one of my favorite episodes to date. I mean, again, so many laughs and a lot of backstory from a guy who...
He's seen it all. He's seen it all.
Yeah.
He's met everyone. And he's had the experiences as a comedian that we all strive to have. And
the voice of Dusty in the new Disney film, Planes.
Sure. Voice of Dusty. He's got a brand new tour coming out, so he'll be coming to a city near you. And but before you see him on tour, you can listen to him right now on the About Last Night podcast with Mr. Dane Cook.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the About Last Night show, taking the show on the road for a second week.
On the road.
We are now coming to you live.
Maybe the nicest house I've ever seen in my entire life, quite honestly.
Casa de Dane.
Is it? Does anybody else call it that?
Welcome, gentlemen. That's how you have to talk when you have a nice house.
You really do. You're like, yeah. I mean, you kind of did when you first walked up. You definitely extended your arms. Like,
you know what? It's like... You almost want to have like theme music when people come over, like something diabolical. Like, gentlemen, I bring you here for a reason.
You're stroking a cat for no reason. Yeah. When did I get a cat?
I have an attaché case.
Always talking about how Inspector Gadget is fucking wronging you in some way.
I'll get you next time, Gadget.
Wow. Next time. It definitely has that aura to it, especially with the hedges so high. It's definitely...
Yeah, the tall ficus. Yeah. Privacy, Adam, okay? You know, I remember as a young child saying, geez, Mom, if we just had a few more high ficus around this... edifice.
Maybe the cool kids would finally invite me to eat lunch with them. If only we could have a ficus.
Well, listen,
come
this on. Is let, you know. Let's just talk about this for a second, because as comedians, we live in dumps for a long time.
Oh yeah.
So you know, I think it's always that thing of like, okay, when I do pretend I'm grown up, then I'm going to have myself a house someday, and also somebody's going to tell me that. Somebody in accounting is going to be like, you know, you're throwing money out the window with this apartment. You might as well.
Right.
So upgrade. People then kind of circumvent you into buying a house, and then suddenly somebody's saying, well, you got to have high ficus because
it's just everyone's
it's only
having
20 grand. Yeah. If you're getting the,
everybody has
doing it.
The built-in ficus.
Right. And then as you're pausing going, I don't know if that's necessary, there's somebody else who just peeks their head into the office door and says, it's all a write-off. Ultimately, it's saving you
by the
money.
Way, that was strategically rehearsed, by the way. Yeah. They were like, all right, when Dane shows apprehension towards the ficus, just fucking pop your head out a little bit and say, you know, it's just a...
But it really is like how many... when I first moved to L.A., I lived on Hacienda, right above Barney's Beanery.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Still a great area.
Right up the street from there. Good area, but still the apartment that I lived in one of the apartment buildings where... you know when the elevator is so – you can swear on your show, right?
Whatever. Oh, yeah. Okay. Everything.
It's such a shitty, shabby elevator that – and you don't want to touch the buttons that you, like, pick a stick up from outside when you go in and you remember.
Oh,
just something. Or you
ask
just
a passerby to press the button for you.
Just some kind
glove.
Of implement to actually hit a button without
you
using –
You have a mitten for simply that purpose.
You just
it's like, oh, no, this is my elevator mitten.
In the lobby.
Perfect. When did you then move into this?
Well, no,
first of all,
that was like 97 when I first kind of really settled out here. So I was on Hacienda for I don't know like a year and a half.
Right.
But I would then walk to the Laugh Factory, and it was because it's right near.
Yeah.
For those of you who are use your Google Maps actually as we're speaking.
Zoom in on
and if you're at home, that's drink two every Dan Cook time. He says Google Maps drink two at home.
So I would walk by this other building, very famous building called the La Fontaine.
Oh yeah,
you know where that is. Mm-hmm. That's also West Hollywood corner, like Crescent Heights and Fountain.
Right.
And it was a very famous building that I happen to know Belushi lived in, Steve Martin lived in.
Jesus.
So I would walk by that every day and be like, I want to live in this fucking building because it's got good the juju.
That's what they said. Yeah.
And so ultimately, I ended up meeting the manager there, and I spent 11 years in that building.
Oh, shit.
Living in Belushi's last apartment. The last apartment Belushi had when he died up at the chateau.
Yeah.
But I lived in his last apartment building for 11 years.
Did you request that? Or like as soon as it got open, you're like, I have to be here?
No, it was the only place that was open, and I loved it the minute I walked into the apartment. I couldn't believe that I couldn't afford it, first of all. That I remember that. I talked to them and talked to everybody into like giving me the opportunity. But I remember day one, moving in there, really not being in a place to actually be able to afford it. And I remember they said, by the way, Belushi lived here, and Bette Midler lived here for a number of years, wrote Wind Beneath My Wings here. Like, people that were in comedy and in the arts.
Jesus, the girl who played Cherry on Punky Brewster lived in my apartment building. So you definitely fucking beat me.
Stop dropping names, Adam. You get one movie under a belt, look at you.
It happens, of a bitch. Man. Now,
I lived there, and literally day one, last thing is that I remember they, you know, gave me the keys and kind of like, welcome to the building. And when they closed the door, it was the first time in my life, career, on my own, where I was like, I need to live up to this place. I need to work hard enough to actually.
I was just
going
to ask to make
this.
You inspired. Yeah,
yeah, and it was scary because, and it was a good scary because I was like, I definitely don't deserve this at this point in my life and career. I lucked out in getting into this, you know, which is a longer story, but basically everything kind of dominoed to me getting in there. But it was.
But you put yourself in a position to have those things happen, right?
It made me work hard, and that place changed my life to the point where I actually had separation anxiety because I had done so many things in my career positively from there, I was scared to leave.
No shit.
Yeah,
so you thought like maybe if you change the surroundings, like you wouldn't create what you had created from there, like the themes wouldn't continue?
Isn't it like, you know how we're a little bit like ball players sometimes where we get a little superstitious on stuff, and there's kind of like, you know, when you have your lucky shirt when you first started doing stand-up?
Yes,
like,
right.
You know, and for years I had like a Ren and Stimpy shirt.
Wow.
And then when somebody's like, you got to stop fucking wearing that shirt. Then I cut a piece of it and had it in my pocket for like another 2 years.
Wow.
You know, we have those weird little, you know, like Adam's hair. He always has to have it. I know the way you do it. It's a blow dry with the round brush.
Wow.
Come on.
He knows.
Wow. Come on, man.
Jesus Christ. Did you Google Earth me today?
But, you know, we have
totally hear you, though, Dan, because I just moved to 2 blocks from the factory, like in Laurel and Hollywood.
Okay.
And I was living next to Pink's for 8 years. And I just moved 2 months ago. I've been there for 8 years since I graduated from college out here. And there was, I mean, on a much smaller scale, but, like, I definitely had apprehensions to where I thought about everything that I did there, like all the videos, like all the ideas I came up with, the bits I wrote, and I had a little bit of like, shit, is my new surroundings not going to be conducive to me being creative? Which is a weird thing to think, but...
Well, I mean, you do have a pool out there that has a lot of chicks sunbathing that kind
of
distracts you.
A lot of chicks and a lot of Persian men with kids who I think they know. And then there's also a couple
comedy
of...
fodder. This is all. I see the sitcom coming together.
Oh, my God.
The guy goes,
so it's me and a Persian dad. Are those his kids?
Just probably not. Box poolside.
Wow, that actually sounds like they would do that.
Yeah, right.
Now, you were telling us a story when we walked in here that you wanted to live in the Hollywood Hills ever since you saw the movie E.T.?
Yes.
What about E.T. made you go Hollywood Hills? Because
I think E.T. Was the first movie that I saw that I knew I wanted to be a comedian since I was a kid, but when I saw E.T., it was the movie that made me want to be a part of, like, the entertainment
cinematic
industry,
okay.
And all that shit. So it was like,
just made me want to eat Reese's Pieces. So I'm completely inspired by this. This is great.
Do you know that Eminem was offered that gig? They said
that
no.
Is a great piece of trivia, and that's fucking insane that they said no.
They said no.
They said no
to this day. You know
why?
I don't know.
Now, obviously, it didn't hurt their company, but like,
you know,
I mean, people think of E.T. and like, yeah, that's one of the first things
pieces.
I think of.
Unbelievable.
And then, but
anyway, not to get off on a tangent.
No, what's your favorite candy bar? I just feel like as a midget, I have to bring up candies whenever I can. You know, just kind of, you know, yeah. It kind of goes with the
thing. Brad has a deal with what is it?
Mars,
the little wafers, the what are they called? The little
wafers,
Smarties,
little wafers, the little wafers.
Little wafer show he's pitching to Fox. Little wafers.
This fall, the little wafers.
It's on the Food Network.
Wait, but is it a family that their last name is Wafers?
From
or is
the
it a
makers.
Family of dwarves who just make wafers.
From the producers of the little chocolatiers comes the little wafers.
And you always make them way too big, and your boss is like, they're too big. The wafers are too big.
They're not big enough for me.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, we don't
We're
even need Dane here for this
track.
Fucking part.
Love it.
All right. So you saw the movie, and what part when you. Saw you. I think you said mentioned
E.T. came through at one point, like he was looking through the shrubs or something. The ficus, the tall ficus. Wait,
oh my God! Did you
Holy
even think about that?
Shit, I never realized that.
It all comes full circle.
That's why I have E.T.'s bushes.
If you want to cry, it's okay.
I have many a nights.
That's all right.
But I saw the movie and I was like, it honestly, without getting too heady about it, I was like, oh, I'm meant to live there someday. It was really not just like, oh, where is that? That looks kind of... It was just almost like I had seen a glimpse of my future residence. I really honestly was... And I've had those kind of moments in my life a few times where I see something and I'm like, oh, that's reminding me. That's where I'm supposed to continue to go to. It's like a it's
how
like
do you,
being drawn
how do you
to
explain that? Is that part of the whole, like, you visualize it, you see, like, what you want to attain? And
I fully believe in that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean... My
if
the
you
secret
will it.
Or all that
yes.
kind of stuff. Yeah, my mother was very much a an enchantress. No, she was
a gypsy.
She's a soothsayer and a gypsy. No, she was just a person that really believed in, like, you know, what you put out there.
Yep.
And sometimes in life there are signs and things that you see, and don't be afraid to be like, oh, that is, that's meant to be a part of my path or whatever it was. So, yeah.
Would it take those signs
into
consideration?
She wasn't a hippie or anything like that. But, she was open to the idea that sometimes you can identify the things that are meant to be in your life through books and films and conversations and don't be afraid to take those things and be like, oh, yeah, that's...
Do you think sometimes we're trying to be too much in control? So, like, allowing yourself to be susceptible to, like, to seeing something and going, oh, shit, maybe I'm not supposed to do that because of, you know,
interesting.
I'm...
Interesting. I think it's a journey we're all on to start going, like, what's the stuff that my alpha ego is like, I gotta have that, I right. want that, mm-hmm. I need to fucking conquer that, versus really identifying as men, like, that's within my pay grade, and that's, like, sure. what I deserve for myself with the hard work that I put in. So it was, you know, through many years of you know, just exploring kind of like your self-truth and, right. you know, not to get too Larry Moss on it all, but like just really being able to identify things that symbolically you think are speak to you.
But like if you were on your way over to audition for the role of Dusty in Disney's Planes, which is out in theaters right now.
By the way, it was not an audition. They offered it to me.
Oh, let's be nice, shit. Dane Cook.
Just so you know, Cherry from Punky Brewster was also up for the role.
Yeah. Look at you go.
But if you were on your way to that, in all seriousness, and let's say you witnessed a mini plane crash, or like you, or there was a big something happened, and it was like front page CNN. Would you see that and go, "Oh shit, I'm in a I don't know, somehow connect the dots"?
Probably not. Maybe right. like so in the moment. No, I'm not like a person that, you know, doesn't take a left because you know, I saw an accident on the left side of the road. Definitely sure. nothing like that. More long form of like, oh, okay. You know, that's ultimately in many years what I would like to participate in, a film like that. Right. You know, I saw Animal House and was like, oh, I want to do an ensemble, like, I want to do an ensemble something, so I need to allow myself to think those thoughts and be opened and mindful
right.
of mm-hmm. those moments. Right. So I think it's just all about kind of being further in touch with your actual abilities and skill set, and what and then saying, I know I can do A, B, and C, and that will equal D,
right.
and not be afraid to say, I will have D, which means I'll continue to sharpen right. A, B, and C.
Like if you were trying to decide whether to go between, like, you know, hey, let's go to Denny's or let's go to IHOP, and like, let's say 2 weeks ago you'd hooked up with a girl named Grand Slam Susan, you're like, all right, well, then I'm going, then we're going to go to Denny's because everything's connecting for
obviously.
That is absolutely where the signs are. That's where Ace of Base, I Saw the Signs, actually is playing on a radio.
Oh, my God.
As you're driving down
Vista. So ridiculous.
I like using street names that nobody uses, by the way.
Yeah.
See, most people would say Sunset. No, yeah, I put us on Vista.
Hey, man. It's perfect.
It's there, too. How come it doesn't get any credit? It's always the big guns.
So you have the ficus and from E.T. You're now living in the hills. And you said you also have a Steven Spielberg story to follow that up, like
Steven Spielberg's because I remember I left the theater that night. A couple of mm-hmm. interesting things happened that night. My mother had taken me to see E.T. It was right near Christmas. We did not have a lot of money. We were, like, you know, welfare family, mm-hmm. and I was on free lunch tickets, all that kind of stuff. And I remember we left the theater, and it was such an impactful evening because the movie, like, something transcended, you know. It was like one of those kind of moments where I couldn't sit down almost. I kept, like, I just wanted to move.
Sure.
And I was...
It also was a movie in the timeline of cinema history, like, you know, as like Jurassic Park was. It was kind of like changing, right? It was the first of its kind that was like that.
Yeah, because it was like this huge epic...
that made kids think that, like, that, I don't know, it just...
By the way, that's my chopper, guy, so I'm going to have to split in a couple of minutes.
I was going
to
say.
Is that Batman sign yours, too? Is it just a silhouette of your abs?
I don't know if that's reading on the audio, but... So I see the movie with my mom, and I'm completely, you know, just taken aback by it. And we leave the theater, and we're sitting on the porch of the front stoop of the movie theater. Like, I wanted to talk about the movie right away. So I was sitting there with my mother, and I'm like, what is this world, and where does that come from? And, like, she's, you know, we're talking about Steven Spielberg, and who's this guy, and how did that... So it was just, like, this conversation about, like, destiny, and how do you become that person with that vision? And I remember saying, like, how do I entertain the world?
Right.
I remember having this conversation, like, Jesus, how do I entertain the masses? I want to entertain the, you know, groups of people. And so we have this conversation. It's certainly like a pivotal moment in my life as far as like, and she was behind me on it. Like, well, let's start educating you on how you can move towards that. And then
That's awesome.
Few minutes later, our car was stolen. Somebody had stolen the car with all the Christmas gifts and all, which my mother had spent. And she had a panic attack. She was like kind of a phobic woman, my mother. And she completely lost her shit in this, you know, everything was gone. And it really almost scared me seeing her like that because she had so, we'd gone from this really wonderful, like, warm moment to seeing
to
this
where's
woman
my slip and slide?
Gone. Everything. Yeah, seriously. Probably was in the trunk at that point. And it was from that night where I really was like, it was like this perfect blend of information about entertainment and about dreams and being able to follow a dream like this Steven Spielberg creature did. Mm-hmm. And when life really fucks with you in a way that's so compelling and brutal that you want to protect yourself to never have something like that happen again.
Holy
so it was like,
shit,
if I have those things from the movie, my mother and my family won't have to feel like everything is gone. I never wanted to feel that way again. Like
and
I've
see
lost
your mom.
Out. Yeah.
Feel it. Yeah.
Yeah. All in one night.
Dude, that's bananas. That
how often do you think about that? That's like a
not very. Just we started talking about Spielberg when you guys first came in, and you know, making fun of my ficus. And
well, observing.
Yeah. I've actually asked you guys here to actually trim them with me. I need some manual labor.
and that's not in
Ficus Buddies, another show.
There you go. And that's just gonna be Adam holding me while I had the trimmers.
Ficus Buddies.
Yeah, yeah. Ficus, this could be the new TGIF. Ficus Buddies and Wafer Brothers, or what was it called?
Little Wafers.
Little Wafers. Little Wafers. I already forgot.
And Poolside.
And Poolside.
This fall, get ready to get foxed. Yes.
Now, you talk so lovingly about your mother. Did you come from a funny family? Were you guys always joking around?
I've talked about how my parents were funny in very opposite ways. My mother was physical, self-deprecating, and like not afraid to be, kind of like put the... Exactly. Take the piss out of her. And literally, sometimes she would take the piss out of herself. She would reach into her pussy.
Put it in your lunch bag.
And it was already in a bag somehow in her. And she would take the piss out of herself.
That's a great bit. Oh, my God. I'm pretty sure Chelsea Handler's going to try to steal
that. You should see when she would shit on herself sometimes. Both in a funny way and in a literal
in a
way.
Medically way.
She'd lay in a tub with her asshole facing the spigot.
By the way, I think we just found the opening scene to Little Wafers.
They called themselves the Aristocrats.
She was funny. My mother's funny.
That's super rare, by the way, to see a parent like introduce you to that type of comedy, right?
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, she was funny and was also like not afraid of language. She would, you know, F-bomb and all that kind of stuff. She wasn't afraid of like letting us watch comedy that was... you know, irreverent and all that. And then my dad
was... What would that be? What would you watch?
Oh, like, you know, HBO's and, you know, anything that was like, again, early Carlin or Pryor and, you know, hearing some of the, you know, crazy language that, you know, words that we'd never heard before.
And so that's obviously contributing to you getting, like, all this comedy influence, right?
Comedy influence.
If you didn't get to see that, I mean...
Both on the side of... Well, comedy influence because even though I loved... you know, like Johnny Carson's and stuff like that, like, you know, kind of like nightly entertainers. I felt like, ooh, this is kind of the cool blue. I'm not supposed to be watching this.
Of course.
Because my dad was a little bit more strict in that sense. But his humor was very, like, he was very, like, dry, you could say. But kind of like, he had like a cool swagger, cool, like, but you didn't know until you knew him that he was being funny. Because everything was so kind of deadpan.
Gotcha.
So that mix really enticed me. I liked...
And was he sparing with his, like, gems? He would kind of pepper things in? Or would he, like, all the time be, like, dropping dry little nuggets?
All the time to where it's like, again, if you meet him, you know, he had this really great speaking voice, too. And it was... I can't think of something he'd say, but if he met you, he'd be like, good to see you again, Adam. Good stuff. Yeah. It was just like this real direct tone to where you couldn't really tell when he was... kind of fooling around with you or if he was just, you know.
It's crazy that you talk about those two dynamics of comedy because I think of your comedy as definitely a mix of that. You have the outrageous high-energy leg-kicking body movement. But at the same time, like when I see you at the factory,
body
rocking, you definitely body rock it. Absolutely.
I think of Jock Jam CDs edition 2 when I watch your comedy.
Sure.
But in
the Jock Jams of comedy,
when I see you at the Laugh Factory, you're talking about you've done rape jokes, you've done stuff like that's very serious, like very crazy stuff that you don't think of like. Dane Cook is like high energy, but then you go into very serious topics. So you really balance both those things out.
I don't think it was just – it was that non-limitation thing. It's like, okay, if the people that I Doug growing up can talk about, you know, everything from, I don't know, politics to farts to whatever else. It's like, you don't want to ever think like this. I didn't want to have really a definitive style. I wanted to be able to grow and change with an audience. I never wanted to feel like I have to be the same guy in my 30s that I was in my 20s. So that changed. And then I think even in the last 10 years, I've grown up with a generation of fans, some of the choices that I make in terms of outside of comedy. But it's really never been about, it's if anything, it's been trying to like grow beyond what I've, you know, done before. Just simply to challenge myself sometimes to try some different things.
And you don't make a conscious effort to do that, do you? Like for like what you're talking about, like now on stage versus like the first bit I ever listened on Heartful of Swallowed from you was the car accident bit. And the way you like break down people like running out and the things people are saying and like, well, I heard it and she was cleaning a dish and I ran out, which by the way, I mean, fucking, it's one of the best bits of it.
Oh,
heard.
Man. Thanks,
and,
dude.
I mean, do you...
Can I just tell you,
do you still think
how it's weird what we just talked about before with that building I lived in, La Fontaine?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The corner of La Fontaine, Crescent Heights and Fountain, the year I wrote that bit, I was living there. It was in USA Today as one of the top 10 most dangerous intersections in the country. That intersection.
Wow.
And there was an accident a week there, every week. And that's how I wrote that bit. I wrote that bit
because... Because people were always out on the streets.
Always coming out.
It was one of those things that was just... it was in your face so much, you were like, all right, I got it.
I have to, because I started realizing... honestly, there was like sometimes multiple accidents there.
And you probably ended up telling people about it, right? And then you're like, all right.
Oh, I'm in the moment, literally saying to people outside, like... How come we're always in our role? How come whatever I was
we're
observing,
back here again? And people are out there not helping. Or they didn't see. They just heard. And they're just telling other people, but thinking they're impacting the situation or helping by telling people that aren't associated with it.
It was like Groundhog Day. I kept seeing the same the same behaviors. And so I ended up, you know, just tying it together. I ended up writing that
sometimes
bit because
I
of that.
My shoes off in a fit of joy.
In a fit of joy.
I mean, dude, I can't even tell you. My buddy, I was my junior year of college at SC out here, and I went home to Seattle. And my buddies, they pull out this album and they and Harmful Swaddle. And we started listening to it, and they were like, "You got to listen to a couple bits," and then we just listen to the whole thing, and then listen to it again. And I mean, and people just the amount. Also, too, you a lot of your bits were like so quotable. I mean, people, do you feel like that helps with the like? I don't know, the word of mouth type shit where people
absolutely
are just,
it was almost like, oh, I have like sound bites, especially back then. I'm uploading them on Napster or wherever it was, like, or making little clips. Anytime you don't think that people are, I don't know, I guess we don't write in terms of like these are things people are going to want to repeat.
Yeah, this will be a catchphrase.
But it's the fact they're listening to it so much that's what finally gives them the, like, they know the cadence and the musicality and the fucking hip way you speak or hit certain words. We don't think about that when we're...
My 10-year-old half-brother, I would show him your shit, and he to this day is a big
Why
fan of
Why do you have to insult him like that? Why do you have to...
Dude, he has a great... I would show him Family Guy and
He's
your stuff.
He's just half a brother.
He was my brother, you're right. But he's to this day a huge fan.
He introduces me as half his podcast partner, too.
Well, that's sick. And, but
I get it.
The same thing, he would like, you know, always, and he'd be like, every time I'd see him, he would like recite the bits to me and stuff. And then like, but the same way where it was like, you know, people would quote a soundbite of a bit and then they'd be like, ah, well, let me just show it to you. And then they just show the whole thing. And then people end up listening to the whole album. I mean, it was like.
Yeah, it's wild because so many things that came off of that album, which is 10 years this September.
Wow.
And you're re-releasing it, right?
Re-releasing it on a vinyl and with remastered, some extra stuff on there. But it,
MySpace helped. All your social media stuff was happening at that time, too.
All that stuff was just starting to really pick up. I recorded that at the Houston Laugh Stop back, that was the first place that had a DAT player. I recorded it. I thought, like, I'm just going to use this as, like, promotional. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who would have thought that it ended up, you know, getting my first record deal, and it just, you know, changed my life.
And did you feel any sort of pressures after that? Because then your second album went, what, double plat? Like the high,
number four on the Billboard charts?
Yeah, right? Like you're the, what was it, the first, like,
Retaliation,
Steve Martin is
right?
The only other comic that, that's fucking bananas. So there had to be a little, you're not obviously trying to do that, but I mean, after the first album success, and now you're getting all this buzz.
But I wasn't afraid of like whatever the sophomore slump is, or like I wanted the name Retaliation and the theme and how that was already in my head from the first one. I already knew what I wanted to do for the second one.
Shit.
And it's so amazing how it's, I think that we create our own failures. I think that we create moments that will fall in on ourselves. I really have this philosophy now as I've gotten older that, like, when something takes a shit in your life, that, like, oftentimes you've participated in that because you're looking for a way out of a situation that you're in. And I believe that at that point in my life, I was, for that era of my, you know, coming up out of, you know, off of Harmful Swallowed, finding fans, I felt like I was never better than I was at that time. It just in terms of the sheer confidence. There's no haters, no backlash, right. no whisperings of like...
All you're doing was gaining momentum and fans.
Just
and
momentum. Yeah,
positivity.
Yeah, why even second guess it? The first thing was almost a fluke, and I'm a lucky motherfucker who worked hard within luck.
You were prepared for the situation.
Totally prepared because I capitalized. The minute I saw it start to work, I was like, oh, this is where I'm... This is my sweet spot. I'm good now. So when the second one was coming around, it was just like, let's just enjoy it. Really, let's just, you know, let's still work hard on it, but I'm not going to doubt anything. I'm fortunate
that,
already.
Right. And do you think that's why opportunities like SNL and things start just coming at you because you were
this podcast?
You were, well, I didn't want to say it, but years later,
right,
you
there.
Must have seen through the ficus this Brad's little body holding a sign saying, in 10 years, will you do the About Last Night podcast? Like, I don't know who that dwarf is, but yes. Yes to whatever he's asking me to do.
What a mind trip that must have been when you hosted SNL to hear that voice. Like, did you hear the voice say, and your host,
Fred Armisen, Dane Kristen Cook, the Goo Goo Dolls, and your host, Dane Cook.
Yeah, wait. You make him sound like a ghost. Like
Ooh, and I would have gotten away with it too. It wasn't for your mainly kids.
Maybe, I mean, to me, that was like that in Living Color for me, comedy wise, growing up. And I mean, I know I've heard you talk about interviews and stuff, but I mean, it was, I can't even imagine stepping out on that fucking star or out of the door, I guess. Maybe even standing backstage.
It was all, I mean, even just getting there the week of rehearsal. And I remember one night because, you know, you write late at night with the, if you want to, not everybody
stays
late.
Yeah, I was going to ask, did you just jump all
I
in?
I asked, yeah. I was like, hey, if you don't mind, I want to just.
It's awesome.
And it was Bill Hader's first year, and Keenan had only been there for a minute. And so I was kind of feeling like I was coming up with them in a way. They were all breaking out since the last generation of cast members had left.
Also, when was the last comic that was just straight, like a straight up?
Lauren had told me it wasn't since Steve Martin.
Or,
since Steve Martin.
A hero of yours, right?
Love Steve Martin. Yeah, absolutely. Just like
that's fucking nuts. Because I remember when your monologue was like 8 minutes of stand up. I was like, this is fucking crazy.
And that was Lauren happening. Again. Lauren Michaels, you know, producer of the SNL. Mm-hmm. And he that was him. He was the because I want to do a skit. I'm like, let me do what everybody else
does.
Yeah,
do a song and dance. Bring out the piano. Do a tap number.
I was like, let's. That's the thing you do here. And he was like, no. I want you to do stand up. I want you to do whatever you want to do. With your stand-up, and he said, because that's your moment. That's when the whole show is yours. The rest of it, you're on our ride.
Yeah.
But in that moment, why don't you choose to take the helm and really, you know, show America what it is that you do in a way that, you know, unless you're on cable, you wouldn't be able to do. And I have to say on this podcast that About Last Night podcast.
Wow, dude.
Plug within the show.
Within the show. Really appreciate that.
You have my consent
Speaking
to use
sound
that
bites,
for the commercial.
We're taking, you're just keeping, dude, 10 years later, still the sound bites are still coming.
He said to me, the second time I did the show, I had a routine that was really probably one of the darkest pieces I've ever come up with on suicide. And
someone you did an isolated incident? No.
It was the early version of that.
Okay.
I did it again.
What was it, writing the note to? Well, whatever. Yeah.
It was nuts. Okay. It was just a lot of stuff that was really...
So you wanted to do this?
I wanted to do it on the show, even though I knew that it was really risque. Yeah. And, you know, but and then the network, once they caught wind of it, They stormed into the dressing room and were like,
oh, wow. Don Pardo's like, I think it's hilarious.
Don Pardo was like, you're not doing
Fred Armisen could do the bit. Musical guest, Vertical Horizon.
Dude, that's not even why. No, we're talking about the bit. Okay.
But he came into the, you know, he came in after I was getting, you know, pretty much tongue lashing from standards of practice, and he was like, I remember he just looked at me, and for everything that people have ever said about Lauren being kind of this scary
puppet master,
you know, I didn't see that. I always saw him as just like a real methodical genius of, you know, comedy, and the way I watched him operate and kind of like work with his gang. But he came in, he closed the door, and he said, "Do you want to do it?" And I said, "I really do." And he goes, I'll take care of everything else. You just focus on.
Wow.
It was like 20 minutes before the show was going to start. They wanted to pull it.
Whoa.
So they were in my head, like, yeah. You know, where my I'm going to, like, the network is going to hate me, and then the president will call my house
right.
and be like,
yeah.
You have offended America. You must leave.
Jay Leno's going to cry.
Oh, Jesus.
But I walking the halls at night at SNL, after mm-hmm. I would leave everybody's, you know, offices, and I would just walk around by myself, look at all the pictures on the walls, and realize, like, man, Aykroyd and Chase and Steve Martin yeah. and Martin Short, who was, like, a guy that I, sure. I really nice. Loved. And it.
What about the call? I mean, like, even, like, just getting the news, because that, to me, I mean.
Yeah, it's I'll tell you, like, the quick version of the story sure. was Lauren had Lauren and the show had come to me in, like, 1995 and wanted me to come in potentially to be the replacement for Sandler.
Was this after Mystery Men?
This I don't even know.
Oh, was this? They wanted the Waffler, didn't they? Did they want the Waffler or
some waffle action?
Or did they want your hit character from the Dennis Rodman movie?
Ugh.
And then the podcast hits a new low.
This is when the podcast this is the intermission.
This is when Brad gets tossed out. This is when Brad gets tossed out like Uncle Phil tossed out DJ Jazzy Jeff on Fresh Prince.
I don't. No, it wasn't. I didn't even know when that was, man. That's
Simon
such a
says.
Blur in my life.
Yeah.
But he, they.
Would no. you be the cast? So replace Sandler. All right.
Sandler, well, and then Marcy Carsey and everybody over there, they wanted me to come in, and I didn't. I didn't audition for SNL because I just knew that I wasn't mentally capable of it because I was mm-hmm. I was still a very fragile young guy,
okay.
even though I was like looked
mean?
Upon as kind of a dominant at the helm guy
yep.
on
mm-hmm.
stage. I still didn't have a lot of social skills off stage,
which are kind of
and you need there,
yeah, yeah,
because it is a fucking battle royale to
it's
get
a
your
collaborative
oh,
fuck
sure,
fest
it's a hustle.
Of just
well, it's
and competitive and cutthroat,
competitive, very competitive,
yeah,
yeah collaborative, but mostly. You know, competitive.
Yeah, you're all sitting in that room with each other, all pitching your sketches to Lauren. I've heard the stories.
Which just listening to that, being in yeah. the room and listening to the way everybody's kind of like selling themselves is, mm-hmm. it's inspiring. But it was also like I'm like, oh, I'm glad I don't have to pitch. I'm like, you get like a tight throat because this is everybody's moment to like
sure.
possibly get on air.
Is it
week.
Similar to when you're like you're in the fifth grade and everyone has their book reports and you have to stand up and read it in front of the class like that same type
nothing
of nervousness?
Nothing like that, Adam.
Fair enough. Great. We'll
is,
be right back
this
with
is
more.
A,
Dan and
this
I
is
aren't
a major
connecting.
Network program of 30 years and you're
yeah,
talking
exactly.
about
the time I read The Chosen. Fair enough. All right. So
I didn't
there
do it.
And you're like,
I didn't do it. I passed on it, and Fallon ended up auditioning and getting it.
Cool.
Oh, by the way, I'm not saying I was offered. I'm saying mm-hmm. they made it very clear. We want Sandler's leaving. We want a young, white, energetic, affable, guitar-playing, singing guy, which I did all those things.
Wow.
And so I didn't do it.
Regrets?
Sometimes it fucked with me, especially like the 5 years after that, before any, you know, MySpaces or, you know,
sure.
Comedy Central specials, you know, none of that was happening. So it was a good little time where I was watching Fallon and kind of being like, damn, man, like,
could have been me.
That would have been my spot.
Yeah.
Not to the point of, like, depression, but,
right.
you know, just, you know, when I'm in the middle of Fuckville nowhere going, like, turn on the TV and there's Fallon. And I'm like, what if I tried? Would I have gotten it?
Sure.
You know, I don't know if I would have. He actually may have always been the guy to get it,
right?
But I never even gave it the old college try.
Of course.
So then you cut to 2006, and Lauren calls me up, and he's like, I want you to fly to New York, and we're thinking about adding some interesting cast members, and wanted to possibly add me as a cast member, almost like what Billy Crystal had done back
yeah,
in the day.
Right, yeah, when he was already an established name, but then decided to
yeah,
come on.
They wanted to do some kind of cool stunt-type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I told Lauren, I was like, you know, I'll fly back to, you know, meet with you guys. But, you know, I'm not really sure if this is what I want because I had a fan base at that point. And
right.
I just, you know, just felt really like in the pocket now. I know what I'm doing.
Yep.
I'm taking my fans and
everything you've built up.
I want to be my Lauren Michaels. I want to find my show for, like, the comics I love and for, you know, so I,
there's something, and there is definitely something to be said about striking on when the timing does kind of present itself, right? I mean,
yeah. You know, do you join someone else's Justice League or do you create a, you know, a gang of heroes, you know, that you can, you know, kind of call the shots with and to and fro?
Sure.
So,
there you go.
So I said, I went back to New York. I had an interesting story that happened at the comic strip, which we can talk about later, with Steve Martin. He actually brought Steve Martin to see me and didn't tell me until I got off
And that's
off
your hero.
Stage.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
So I walked off stage and my best friend said, do you know who Lauren brought to see you tonight? And I said, yeah, I think he brought Tina Fey. And he goes, he brought Steve fucking Martin. And it was one of the best sets I'd ever had in New York City.
It's unbelievable.
But Will Tarantino wouldn't come back to that.
What if
minute.
He said, just kidding on Steve Martin, it was Maya Bialik?
It's Ruth Buzzy that he brought. But she is
Remember
wet.
Remember Joey Lawrence? Well, it's his youngest brother. That's incredible.
All right, so I say to Lauren, with the most amount of respect, you know, it doesn't feel like my thing. But I said to him, but I'd love to host.
Wow.
And he, you know, it wasn't really, it was kind of received in a way Lauren receives most things, which is, you know, he's pretty, you know, passive, and then they go somewhere, and then I got a call, it's not going to happen. Yeah, it's like, it's not going to happen, and basically saying no comic has come back and done that, and that's just not the way we do things anymore. And then 4 months later, I was at the comedy festival in Vegas. Retaliation did
what it did. Yeah.
And Lauren called me up, and he said,
it's time.
You're right. He's like, you're right, and you should host.
You're right. Holy shit, man.
Yeah, he goes, you're right, you should host. Would you like to host Saturday Night Live? I'm saying it again right now.
Dude, that's fucking Goosebump City, man.
And I was like, no, I'm good.
No, I'm good. I don't think it's the right time in my life or time in my career.
Yeah.
You know what? I got this fight because I got a trim. that's a fucking standstill moment.
It was, and that, again, we're talking about, this is all still the era of Good Times USA. There's nothing that this industry eventually does, which is flip the script on you. And there's the ebb and the flow. There's no flow yet. The pendulum's still in fucking, you know, the infield. It's just all, that's like glory days, golden era. Like, man, that's before the tough stuff that we all have to eventually deal with.
Had you been made aware at all in the business by anybody that, like, as the success is as climbing, that, like, the backlash is coming?
Oh, I knew.
Or were you, like, just naive enough to be like, this is all great? And
no, not naive, but, like, telling my family, like, you realize that this has been so good. The pendulum thing that I would say is, like, that it will swing the other way. That's
it's
life,
just like,
right?
How long do we get? Like, to
totally understood that, you know, whatever bad cliche, the higher they rise, the faster they falls, and all that kind of stuff. Like, I knew that I could do everything I could to try to, pad it or, weather storms or whatever. But I did know that at some point something was going to give.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, let's just, you know, harvest. Save as much money as I can, get while the getting's good, and hopefully the diehard fans will stay with whatever happens.
Sure. And they have. I mean, look at your every social media. You're killing. You're selling out. You're about to go on this tour.
Yeah.
And
that's the Under Oath tour that you're talking about.
Yes, the Under Oath tour
starts September 12th.
Ooh,
in Washington D.C.
At the DAR Center, right?
Where can we find the dates and tickets, Dane?
It's I'm sure it's probably on a website called DaneCook.com.
Sure, I've heard of that. Yeah, that's your name. Plus a .com.
And you've gone through, like, every spectrum comedy. You've played, you've done...
Yo, Madison Square Garden, you're the one of two?
Six. One of six comics to sell it out.
Gosh, still not very many.
Yeah. So such a letdown after you said two, and then I was like,
only six of us, and then thousands of comics have done it. Only six of us. You've done shows at, like, the Pepsi Center in Denver and the Madison Square Garden, the Fleet Center in Boston. These are where basketball teams play. And they're...
That's right, Brad. Yes. We'll be right back with more obvious fucking facts from Brad Williams. No, you're right, though. But it's a big deal.
There's a lot of space in the
air. Yeah. But, like, when you go from, like, a bar show like Dublin's, which was the greatest bar show of all time.
Yeah.
You're
like a little arena, man. I'm telling you. It was like... It? Like a 300 people arena.
All I've heard stories about it. If you want to give any sort
real quickly, because I don't want to interrupt. Brad was he was really building up to
a great compliment.
The Deus Ex Machina was going to come down. Dublin's was just like a cool joint, almost like the West Coast Cafe Wa to New York, which is where you could go in a free show on a Tuesday night in the attic of a fucking bar that had no business being a comedy room, and yet I feel like it elevated comedians' performances to another level, and I know it certainly taught me a lot, and I had some of my best shows in L.A.
Oh,
or anywhere there.
Now, I don't want to James Lipton it, but why?
You just have a stroke?
I think I did. I'm sorry.
What just happened?
I tried to say James Lifton to distract you from the stroke I was having, to think that that was the impression. No, but like, why? What about the room?
Worst Lipton I've ever heard.
Well, let me try to redeem myself later in the episode. Wait. If you could, if you got to heaven. Oh, Steph, now it's Sean Connery. Yeah. What is a Sufi?
It's a Sufi. What was the first of the 9 questions that you just asked me?
What about the room at Dublin's elevated your act? It was just not conducive.
I don't
for
know,
comedy.
Man. It's kind of like, what's funny? It's like, who knows? It was just something
things.
There was something in the ether. You got up into that attic and you just, you know, I did a lot of shows with Bowden there.
Yeah.
And Bowden was, he'd be like,
Lonzo Bowden.
He'd just go like this. Yeah. We don't question it. We don't question it. Like, let's not even try. Because we'd be like, can you? He'd be like, man. We just don't even question it. So it was that thing of like, don't question it. It's just an amazing room, and hopefully it'll stay for a minute.
And it got to be like a hot spot for celebs and shit, right?
It did. Yeah. There was a lot of beautiful, you know, women and models. And, you know, and then there was like, you know, the Johnny Depps and, you
what?
Know, just act. Yeah, a lot of big actors coming through. Bruce Willis was there on one night, dying hard.
just a Hollywood hotspot. I remember when I first got to LA, people were like, "You got to go to Dublin's," and they specifically mentioned you. Like, this guy Dane Cook is just fucking crushing it.
Well, I went because Chappelle actually went. Went one night, because I had no interest in going. I was like, "What? I didn't even know what this place
show,
is." Yeah, it's kind of weird. And you know, the Factory was always packed for me, and it was. Yep. I love the Factory. And then Chappelle went. And I was like, "Well, if Chappelle can go, then I'll go over there."
Yeah.
So, it ended up being because Ahmed Ahmed was running the room with Jay Davis back then, and it just turned into it. Really, Dave kind of put it on the map, I think, from his showing up, and then a lot of people went to be like, "Oh, where's Dave performing?" And then we all done it.
Did Danny Bonaducci ever perform there?
I think he blew a man in the bathroom there once
for HGH. That was amazing.
For all you improvisers out there, that's how you guys end.
But it really was, I mean, no joke. It was almost like it felt like the same way like some of the bigger shows I've done in my life. And the Cafe Wa and the Comedy Cellar and even the Laugh Factory, sometimes just something happens in there. It doesn't matter if you're in front of 20,000 people or those rooms packed. It's like it feels like you're there's something elevating your performance.
Gotcha.
You know, it's not just about the room you're in or the reputation of it. It's like it's about the crowd and the time
and
where
watching.
You're at.
Sure.
Yeah.
So now going from clubs to theaters and arenas, like, is that even something you can prepare or practice for? Or are you just like, I've got energy and I'm moving around, so this will be a no-brainer?
It's
like Rough Around the Edges, that was in the round, right? Is that the
question? That was Madison Square Garden, that was in the round. But
Vicious
everything
Circle,
leading up to Vicious
Circle,
Vicious.
Also, yeah.
But 15 years earlier, I was doing a show at the Cape Cod Melody Tent, which was
I've been there,
2,300 seats in the round. Mm-hmm. And so in 93, I was playing the round, 93, 94, and loving it, and just immediately having like a connection to that kind of stage. And then I remember watching George Carlin in the round. It was a show he did in Arizona years, like 70 and something.
Oh, at
like,
the Celebrity Theater.
I believe the Celebrity Theater, which Marty Culliner directed. And Marty Culliner directed my show in the round at for Vicious Circle.
That's awesome.
But it was anytime I'd seen round shows, I always dug it. And so, you know, in the years leading up to that, as the college shows grew, I would end up playing There was never like one night where I was like, it went from 300 to like I'm in an arena. It was like every year for about 12 straight years, it was like, you know, okay, 1,500 and hey, there's 2,000 students here today. And now it's like 3,200. It really every year was like,
slowly grew.
And then Penn State in 95 was the first time it went from, we think we're going to sell 5,000 tickets to like 12,500 tickets. That was during Tourgasm. That's when I was like, I'm going to do an HBO special in an arena. I'm going to do this round show, this massive round show.
And it just I remember the look of that show was just unbelievable cuz like the you had so many crowd shots and you just as comics you just kept looking at that going, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
And
it was didn't like the backdrop was a crowd.
Yeah.
It didn't seem too big either. Like I feel like the laughs were all carrying and your timing wasn't being thrown off from what I like listened to and watched.
That's why the round actually is appealing because when you do it, what is it? Proscenium.
Yeah.
When you do that, I can understand there's some kind of like bounce or I don't really like larger shows actually of that level. But I like doing it in the round because it's like four theaters at any point when you turn.
Wow. You also knew
it's
how
better
to
for
play.
Sound. Yeah. It's just better for. I think it just works better a round show.
You also had just an innate performer's ability to play the room and like not, you know, like you have to otherwise.
Yeah, you got
to
be like a real showman to get in there.
Totally.
But you know what? I'll tell you this, Adam. They anytime I brought comics out on the road with me, even comics that were maybe more cerebral or. Like a
Gary Goldman or
like
something.
Like a Gary Goldman, you know, like, you know, somebody. Yeah, Gary Goldman's a perfect example of, like, anybody who over the years I put in front of those crowds. Even Ben Glebe on my last tour or even, like, Newberg I brought, you know, when he wasn't doing the crowd-pleasing guitar stuff.
Sure.
Like, you know, his whole thing is, like, everything's just kind of like that low-key.
Fozzie Bear?
And every he does kind of sound like Fozzie Bear. But it works. And I think also it's a testament to my comedy fans are like, they love stand-up. Not just, they're not snobs. No. They come loving all kinds of different.
That's awesome. And also just getting to the fact that the point of having a following. Like I just, like where people are coming for you, right? That's got to be a moment where you go, okay, now I'm not going to try to build fans. Now they're just coming out in the masses.
Which is the greatest feeling. And then at the same time, it's a weird thing because. As again, I don't know if this is just like men in comedy. It's like that early comic mind of like nobody knows me and I need to win.
Yes,
mm-hmm. I miss that sometimes.
Really,
I still do. Yeah, that's why I like walking into a room where maybe people aren't necessarily there just for me.
Sure,
because
to try to win them over,
or there's people that are now are like, oh, I would never. I don't really like this guy.
Yeah,
and then you can kind of see that shift, or so that's. The new version of the challenge, but I miss those early days, man, where it was like, and we all want to get out of that, everybody. It's like, I want to have a fan base. But you do miss being like the gunslinger that nobody knows has the fastest draw in the room.
And you get off and people being like, who the fuck's that guy?
Right.
What's
your name again?
Yeah.
Like,
Those stories of people walking up to you after the show, like, we got free tickets on the street corner. We had no idea that it was going to be like this. This is insane.
Dwayne Cook, you were great.
Is it easier when you have your following coming up for you? Or
what's easier to pay the mortgage? I'll tell you that because you know that they're going to come in and pay their hard-earned dollar, and you're going to, you know, it's certainly more of a you know, it's a collaborative effort at that point, but you still do miss those. There's something glamorous about those early days of like, I got to go in and just miss.
Just like, are you talking about like before the Essence, like after Harmful Swallowed came out and you were at the factory like every weekend and you were just like building it at that point? Is that?
Yeah, think of it like this. Back in that time when Harmful first came out, people starting to go like, who's this guy? What's this about?
Yes.
Then they go, they still aren't really sure. They may have heard a nugget or here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And in clumps of 300, it's like, win.
Yeah,
like
you.
Like 300
they feel like
at a time, gotcha.
Yeah,
and you
right.
see comics doing this once in a while, and there's even, I was just saying recently, like, I think your group of comics or the guys that I see now are some of the best. I think the next generation of comics is like, there's a wealth of great comics and great mm-hmm. voices. But at that time, there wasn't a lot of guys. There wasn't. There was a lot of generation before me guys that were still kind of languishing and hanging,
and like
with all due respect.
Back, maybe coming back to the club.
So I was coming in and just going like, I was just like coming up to the blackjack table or poker table being like, my pile.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful because everybody was leaving and being like, what did we just see?
Yeah.
And that was so awesome.
Yeah.
Because that's what we dream of like, how do I find my fans mm-hmm. and then find them like in groups?
Yeah. Now when you have your fans now, when you do have your crowds, do you feel it's more pressure because they have a certain expectation where when people were discovering you, they didn't have an expectation. They just said, oh, who's this Dan Cook guy? But now they're coming going, I'm seeing the guy that sold out Madison Square Garden.
It's so weird, man. I'm like, I think I'm in a transition. I'm in another transition part of my life. Mm-hmm. And it's tough to answer this, which is why we're going to have to come back in a year. Thanks, everybody. Have a great night.
Check out Little Wafers on Fox, Tuesdays, 8, 9 Central.
Bullseye.
And Midnight's on Fox. I really want to understand your question, too, because mm-hmm. You said
well because right because it used to be you would go out there, people wouldn't know you, yet they had no expectations
right.
of what you are. Now people, when they buy a ticket to see Dane Cook,
okay.
they're going, I'm seeing the guy that sold out arenas. I'm seeing the guy that was number 4 in the Billboard
okay.
charts. So you have to live up to
that. I'm in a transition of there was like a there was a few years until, like, I don't know, maybe like last year, mm-hmm. to where I did feel that. I felt like, okay, based on everything I accomplished and then based on even like some of the hardships and like, you know, things that, you know, the stuff that's ahead of me, you know, the preconceived notions, the stuff that like what's real, what's true, what's not. Like, I did feel all that for a while, so mm-hmm. I would go into a room feeling both excitable because my fans and a bit defensive because some people are, you know, just trying to put a scarlet letter sure. on you. And then, I don't know, maybe great therapy or just, you know, something happened in the last – and again, I'm in it now, so it's tough to really identify it, but now it's almost like – I was talking to Greg Fitzsimmons about this, and I think it's just like now there's like this I'm in this place of like, I've been doing it 23 years, wow. and I think there's just like an overall appreciation for me at this point, or somebody who's like hung in there.
Sure.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, because yeah. you had that time in your career where, yeah, you were taking some punches, but now you're coming out. It's like, hey, I'm still here.
Yeah.
I'm still killing it. So you can't say that you took me down. You can't say that you stopped me.
It's just
me.
Come around to just funny yeah. again. It's just come around to just about the show again. Like, yeah, what do you, mm-hmm. instead of like stuff that went along with it?
You definitely feel that, yeah? I mean, like,
I do.
Past, like, where you're like, no, I can walk
most
in now.
Most fun I've had in the last 2 years, probably, you know, versus the last five or six that were just.
Is that why you took a break for like a year or so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to kind of.
Well, that was coming off my parents had died and my brother, you know, I had to put in jail. And so it was like, I needed time to really figure out who the fuck I was and how to deal with certain things that I just. I didn't know about grief and certain things I didn't know how to...
You hadn't had any sort of loss or any sort of...
Before my parents, no. Mm-hmm. No. And I lost both my parents. Then my brother, you know, steals from me. So he died, basically. Because the person right. I knew who was my brother. Yeah. Then my mentor had a stroke. And Patrice O'Neill. So I pretty much lost, like, five unbelievable people in my life.
Dude, how many... I mean, how often does that happen to anybody in a
it's
year?
Nuts.
I mean, that's...
Yeah. I have so much more empathy, you guys, for people that are, you know, I just understand loss in the simplest of terms
sure. yeah.
and what that really, the gravity of that and what it really truly does to you and how important it is to have people be very stark and real with you. So even mm-hmm. if it's not what you want to hear, I have a greater appreciation of both wanting to receive that and setting up boundaries and knowing how I can get that from people and then also giving that to people as well. You know?
Fuck, yeah. One of the, and maybe this is a prime example of this, do you think that maybe...
Prime example should be a movie.
With Harrison Ford?
Prime
and
example.
Jean-Claude Van Damme making his comeback.
Prime example!
Okay, wait a second.
Oh my God, please build
Can
this
we
up.
Just build this up for a second?
Absolutely, okay. prime example starring
who's the
Jean-Claude
villain?
Van Damme.
Jean-Claude Van Damme comes back, but he's going to be with Harrison Ford, which is going to give him some real, you know, it's going to give him... That anybody coupled with Harrison Ford, that's like you're in the cool camp again.
Yes,
right.
Immediately, no matter where people kind of place you before, it's like, oh, I'm doing a movie with Harrison
yes.
Ford.
Done. And you're
ding,
back.
Ding, ding.
Can the yeah. guy who was his like sidekick in Indiana Jones and the butler in Trading Places be like his like secretary or some sort of his helper who does
okay,
his
I'm
short
work? I'm going to say this: the first
short round comes
is,
back.
Is don't deny. So I'm going to go with you on that. But no, I'm going with you. But absolutely not. Adam.
All right. So then, who's the villain?
Who's the villain?
Prime example. Oh,
dude, that's unreal.
Great. it's either an action film with Van Damme, or it's yeah. somehow it's about steak.
like Catherine Zeta-Jones takes over a restaurant or something.
A rom-com
fucking
yeah. with steak.
She's a vegan. She takes over
worst.
A steak restaurant.
She's a hardcore vegetarian, yeah. but her crazy dad leaves her his slaughterhouse,
played by Tony Danza.
And he's like, boy, you know what I love is steak, but I'm really starting to like this new girl.
They're like, who, Catherine Zeta?
Yeah.
With special appearances by Christian Slater. You know, I don't know what I'm doing here, but I'll give you a prime example that everybody's going batshit crazy.
And the moment where you say the name of the movie in the movie, everyone goes, ah, that's the name of the movie. They said it.
And Fred Savage as the janitor.
who just mops up the cow guts.
But he never says anything. You just hear Daniel Stern's voiceover.
Oh, very good.
Oh, yeah. good
deep
good
cuts
call.
Right
deep
there.
Cuts. Deep Cuts, which is a sequel to Prime Example.
Wait a second.
Oh,
hold on.
Wow.
Get out those steak knives. It's time
again.
For Deep Cuts. Deep if cuts. You liked Prime Example.
Deep Cuts also sounds
you're
like
you're going to salivate over Deep Cuts.
That's a great poster. Deep Cuts also, though, could be a really awful softcore porn. Like, where you're fucking people with lesions and just
starring
deep cuts.
Starring the Suicide Girls.
Maybe Deep Cut sounds like the short film the guy who made Two Girls, One Cup tried to make, and he didn't get enough financing for it.
I could just hear people right now, like, we got to rewind this whole part because they're on, like, the third tier of Dante's Inferno. And they're still on where people are up to their neck in ice.
Maybe Pierce Brosnan could do the voiceover.
Reeling us in. Reeling. Yeah, fair enough. I don't know where we were before that. I think we were talking about
the
melancholy years.
Yeah, then we went right there into prime
but
example.
You know what,
and
that's
deep
great,
cuts.
Man. We get serious and we get funny.
Yeah.
But what I was going to ask before
you,
we went
you,
on.
You were the audience's thoughts just then, yeah. Adam. That's what you just did.
Yeah.
You were the narrative of the audience's thinking. Somebody's listening going, you know, we get the funny and we get the serious. You son of a bitch. Hey, your name was just on the marquee over at the World Famous Laugh Factory.
First time ever.
Yeah, it was.
Congratulations, man. That's honestly, that's awesome.
Yo, Dane, you have to just hold that thought because I have to tell the story.
Yeah, no problem.
Is this a long story?
No, it's like 20 seconds.
It's busting your chops.
I appreciate that you even said that because 7 years ago when I started stand-up, I was dating a girl in New York, and we'd gone to SC together, and she moved out there to be in the Page program at NBC, which, by the way, I was out there when you did your SNL thing, and I saw during the rehearsal you were doing a sweater sketch where you had to put on a bunch of sweaters.
Yes.
And I think you choked on something.
I really did.
Yeah. I was watching that through a fucking window, man, and now we're here.
Yeah, you were upstairs on, like, the tour.
She gave the tours, and I was with her, and she's like, Dane Cooks, and I was, again, giant fan. We were watching Vicious Circle, I think, came out maybe shortly after that. Anyway, so I'm looking down, and you were fucking doing it was during rehearsal, right? The sweater thing.
Yes, and one of the hairballs.
Yes.
One of the pieces of this crazy sweater floated into my mouth.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so I had, like, the driest hairball or whatever it was from the sweater in my mouth, and I almost choked. And I was like, this is going to happen
live.
Dude,
I was watching that from a fucking window. Like, right after it happened, because everyone had stopped, and I said people.
Still feel it.
And that's one of those things where no one, that thing's small enough to where no one really sees it go in your mouth. All of a sudden, you just start choking. Like,
but I could see them flying off during the live show. So if I breathed in, it was going to basically suck it into my gullet.
So she's out there, and I'm here in L.A., like, doing stand-up once every 4 months, doing bringer shows at the Comedy Store, like, not sure if I want to do it, just trying not to be depressed about missing her, and, you know, super just huge fan of you, and all of a sudden I would start being like, I gotta be around something happy that's, like, fun for me, because I'm sitting home waiting to hear about her being like, I'm at an SNL party, and John Stamos is here. One second.
Fucking
hey,
Stamos.
Get your fingers out of me, you know, or whatever he was, you know, I didn't want to hear those phone calls. So I would go to the Factory, Dane, and I would, first of all, I'd look on the site, and I'd see, when your name was either there, I'd, like, immediately call and buy a ticket, or I'd hit and refresh.
I'm still thinking of get your fingers out of me.
That's on the poster from Prime Cuts.
Get your fingers out of me. Prime example, Deep Cuts.
Yeah.
Do you want in on this or not, man?
I'm sorry, man. I'm trying.
So that
short-term memory.
So I would go to the Factory, right?
Yep.
And I would, and your name would get added sometimes last minute, and fucking shit would sell. I'd call 10 minutes later, they'd be like, sorry, we're sold out. I was like, are you fucking crazy? I just refreshed it 10 minutes ago. Sometimes I would just show up, and Jay Davis was there one time, and I had seen him somehow, and he was such a cool guy, and he was like, yeah, man, cool. I worked at a casting office that he had auditioned for something for. Oh, right. So he was like, cool, man, I'll get you in the show. I would stand in the back, no joke, or up in the top, because there were just no seats, and watch you murder in a way that I've never, to this day, and I quote this all the time, I've never seen somebody hold the crowd in the palm of their hand to this day the way you did. It was fucking mind-blowing, man. Like, and you talking about when you were just those days of being, you know, right after Harmful, I guess, and where you were just, like, still just
blind white rage.
Yes, man. And these people, but, dude, I mean, it was people hanging on your every word. Like, and I would then stop watching you and watching the crowd, man. And it was bananas. There was no heckling. There was no, it was just everybody was having, liked you so much. And also, so I'd watch that and get super intimidated because I yet didn't know that you develop your own point of view and you become your own voice. So I was like, is this what I have to do? I can't do this. I don't know if I have that type of energy in me.
Right.
And then it also, on the flip side, though, inspired me to go, that looks like so much fucking fun. And do it. No joke, man. Yeah. It was 7 years ago. And then, she moves to Reno. She ends up fucking a camera guy, blah, blah, blah. She's a TV reporter.
We've gone through this story a few times.
Yeah,
hey, you, get your fingers into me. What she's saying to this guy.
You know what's funny, man?
Hey, so camera A.
She ends up
jam those digits.
She ends up cheating on me with a camera guy, and as she's telling me, I was like, I didn't. You don't. When you're hearing the cheat, you want to ask questions that you don't want answers to.
Yeah.
And I'm a comic, so I deal with the tragedy. We're trying to make a joke, so I go. Oh, so when you told me he was shooting your stories, was he shooting them on your face? And she's like, why would you say that? I was like, I don't know how to deal with this.
Yeah.
Anyway, we finally break up. I'm like, sorry, I told you this was a shorter story. We finally break up. I go, I have no reason to not pursue this full time. I started going to the factory, open mics, started like, you know, just hang out, driving.
Send that girl a fruit basket, man.
Dude, totally. And
filled with fingers.
But I finally got a show when I at the factory, and you popped in, and you for sure won't remember this because you talked to so many people.
Bumped you.
No. I don't know. You actually went. No, you
crush his dream right here.
It was maybe like 20 people. And first of all, I'm like, God, this is so cool. He's coming in for 20 people right now. People went ape shit. I sat there and I was just like, oh, I'm from Seattle, blah, blah, blah. And he liked tips. I just was like, let me get this, my fucking hero. Let me get like some quick little something. And you were cool. Do you really?
Yeah.
In the corner of that booth. And I was just like, and you were just like, man, just keep doing it. Like, keep.
I feel like that was really not that long ago. That's how quick, you know, just
7 years ago.
7 years ago. No, yeah. I feel like if we had talked about that at the club, I would have been like, oh, that was like, you know, 2010.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
But, dude, I mean.
But you're great, man. I really like what you're doing. I will say it. The feeling is mutual. I'm a big fan. Now, Brad, what do you do?
I just kind of stand there.
I really dig what you do up there, man.
Well, that's, I mean, unbelievable to hear.
But how does this translate into dollars for me, Adam?
Well, he's asking the important question.
Will you fund the About Last Night podcast tour and host it?
How much am I getting paid to have to listen to that story?
I know, right?
Now, you'll cut that entire chunk out, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sure, yeah. That's not in there at all.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Dude, yeah. This is all just funnies, yeah. By the way, there's two listeners being like, you know what? I thought they were going to have no more heart in this podcast, but they just peppered in one little story.
We are going to pump this thing up to 40 listeners by the end of this.
We're doing it.
Tweet.
Anyway, thank you.
That's the bottom line of that story, I guess.
That's great, man.
When you were saying like Rodney, like guys, when you started getting into it, who were the guys that you were like?
I'll tell you, I have a few stories like that of like guys that I mean, a bunch of them were in Boston that unfortunately never hit the mainstream, you know, but like guys that if I name them and you're from Beantown, you'd be like, oh, man, the legends of Boston kind of guys.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a bunch like that I came out, you know, guys like Kevin Knox or Don Gavin and Steve Sweeney. These guys were like.
They were in the documentary on Boston Comedy.
When Stand Up Stood Out.
Yeah.
Which is, you got to see it. If you like stand up, you know, When Stand Up Stood Out is a great, great documentary. Basically, Lenny Clark had.
At the Ding Ho,
which was kind of like the Dublins or the Cafe Wa of Boston.
Sure.
He was the first guy to have like one of those old school video cameras and bring it backstage.
Oh, no shit.
So he's got footage, you know, from, you know, it's kind of funny seeing him hold like this massive
RCA bazooka.
Basically. Yeah. But, you know, coming up with those guys. So those were like my like being on a show with them, but being intimidated to even talk to them.
Right.
And also doing shows with them where. It wasn't maybe a compliment of like, hey, you did great tonight, where you'd see these guys after and they go, what the fuck was that? And you just had to figure out, okay, I don't want that reaction again.
Right,
so,
right.
And then as I, you know, went through the Comedy Cellar, you know, every night getting bumped by Chris Rock or Ray Romano was always there at the time, Colin, because he was doing, I think, SNL. And so these are the guys that would knock me to 3:30, but I would just sit and watch them all night. And if I did a few minutes and they saw me and came up more like, I like that thing you did. It was like, I'm at home and I'm just thinking like, oh, okay, great. I'm, you know,
how do I build on that?
How do I build on just, that fragment. So, and then Rodney, when I was out here and I've been really fortunate, man, to be on a lot of, you know, what I think is, I always said I would love to be a part of a great show as opposed to just being the best part of a show. It's such a camaraderie thing of comics.
Yeah.
And even though we're all kind of like, if we can all pull the crowd but make a great evening that they're never going to fucking forget, that's the ultimate win.
Yeah.
Well, you look at when you did Tourgasm. That was four completely different comics between Jay Davis, Gary Goldman, Robert Kelly, and yourself.
Right.
I mean, you took your friends on the road. What a great thing to do.
Were you pretty stoked to be a part of?
I was stoked, but that was not – well, two things. First of all, it was just, yes, I wanted to bring them on the road to – you know, make a great home movie. It was I did not have a deal with HBO at the time. I had no clue it was going to end up on HBO. That was a fluke that it ended up on HBO. Wow. Because I recorded it for just DVD extras or something. Yeah. Or, again, just for me later. Mm-hmm. Maybe nobody would ever see it. But I had a meeting with Chris Albrecht, who was the head of HBO at the time, about my special. And when he was like, what are you up to? I was like, I just did a documentary. He was like, oh, let me see it. And in his office, I put in the scene of Jay Davis and Robert Kelly fighting on the bus. Yeah. And he was like, I remember Chris Albrecht was so nonchalant. And he's like, yeah, I want to buy this. I want to air this. And so that's how that ended up being up and turned into a series. So we didn't know when we were making it that it was going to be. But I still brought those guys for the sake of like sharing this thing that was happening in my career of like, guys, these crowds are getting pretty big.
Yeah.
And I was talking to somebody the other night who said, I'd never want to play 20,000 people, a comedian. And I said, why? And he said, he just had his philosophy on it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this is why you do want to do it at some point in your life, if you can do it. I go, because, and this is why I bring other guys to do it. Because as comics, we do a late night show, and millions of people might be laughing at home. You think millions of people are watching, great. Or you might do like a theater show, and maybe like that's a couple thousand people, and it's a great. But it's really all we're ever looking for is like, wow, that visceral moment of like, my idea is everybody's agreeing with at once. Yeah. Like, we're all on the same page. I said, until you've stood in front of 20,000 people and heard them all go, yes, at the same time, because it's funny to the room, you do want that. It's really why we do television. It's why we do, because you want to get that the largest laugh possible. Yeah. And that's what I love to kind of share with, you know, my peers.
It's funny to the room. That's a great way to put it. Just everybody's in agreement.
Everybody's
that many people
at the same time. Black, white, fat, skinny, fucking whoever, sluts.
hopefully they're there.
Hopefully all kinds. Fat, white, skinny,
dweebs,
Jewish sluts.
Nimrods.
Little wafers.
That's such a perfect moment. Yeah,
yeah, dude. At what point do you go from now I want to try to translate from all this stand-up success and get into movies and do what my some Steve Martin shit?
Yeah, it's like you want to do those things.
Or is that not a part of your?
It was always a hope. It was always a hope to like bring my fans into film and television, but the way it happens is actually so the opposite of what you think. It's really just directors start becoming fans. They like your stand-up. I'm sure there's guys that are seeing you now that are, in a few years, they're going to be the next guy. And you'd be surprised at, you know, who you're palling around with now, who might be a temp or an assistant. And then in a few years, you're part of their lineage. And so when some director so-and-so sees you and you guys chat after, and then he's like, oh, man, I'm really big fan. Now he's coming up. Well, he wants to put the people that influenced him and entertained him when he was shit out of luck, you're going to get that call. So it's like, just by being primed up and at your best, I got calls from people who were like, you want to come play? You want to be the lead in this thing or be a part of? And so that's really the way it started to happen. I wanted it to happen, but it was so kind of like easy in terms of like, oh, all I had to do is just be good at the one thing that I, you know how to do.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the message kind of for most comics is like, you know, because, oh, I need a TV agent. I need a film guy. And how do I get into
the real?
It's like, no. You just need to spill over every night on stage the best that you can. And that is going to get somebody's feet wet with your shit, man. Somebody's going to be like, you're going to be all over somebody just by being on point.
And they are going to remember that when they're making their project and go, oh yeah, that guy, that's a perfect part for this guy. And I mean,
how did when you did Heat? How did that?
Yeah, I mean, Allison Jones, who cast it, who cast The Office and Curb and just lots of Will Ferrell comedies and Superbad and shit. I've been going in for her for 5 years, and sometimes going in for bigger parts just to get in front of these people that she was just like, I think you're right for this, but Ed Helms is going to get it. But she's like, still come in for it because I want you to get in front of this person. And then some things I would get close on, and then little parts on The Office all the time, and then. But I got on her short list, So then when I saw this, and that's what I've been hearing is just like, you know, building fans in the casting community. And so I now I've been in for a ton of people, and now I can be on the short list, but like still and getting close, but still beating losing out to somebody who, you know, maybe just left the show and is coming over. I mean,
right.
All the stuff that's out of your control. But then for Heat, it was just when I saw it, I was like, oh, cool, another awesome movie that's just fucking, you know, Bonaducci's going to beat me out for. And and then I went in and ended up going in for two different parts and another different part. And then Paul just liked what I did on tape. And, you know, he was on, came on our podcast and told me, he's like, I didn't do you any favors, man. He's like, I just, you know, he's like, sometimes it's tough to cast off tape. He's like, sometimes somebody kills it in the room and then you show it the tape and you're right. Like, shit, it didn't, I don't know what we saw there. But he's like, you just, you know, had something or whatever. And you know, again, it's like, I still, even when I saw the first thing, I was just like, there's, you know, there's no reason why I could have not gotten, you know, I just...
But you look and you say...
But I remember walking out being like, I crushed it. Like, I feel like I do... you know, I prepare and I feel like I leave thinking I should... There's no reason why I shouldn't get this. But then you just, you know, you condition yourself to go, you know.
But this is what's so awesome about stand-up. So you've got these casting people. Now you've got, you know, crew, producers, people that, you know, were involved behind the scenes. You have a central place to invite all of them for a night out. And it's to come see your show.
And you've gone from comedies, but you also did dramas as well.
Yeah, Dan Real Life, Mr. So
Brooks, Dan Real Life, which isn't really a drama, but like a dark comedy. But
which one?
Dan Real Life with Steve Carell.
It's a dark comedy.
Jeez, I don't know what category that's under. It's kind of rom com.
It's a slice of life, right?
I think. But like, did you make a conscious decision from the beginning? Like, I'm gonna go into not just. Like, I'm not just going to do comedy movies. I'm going to try to do dramas as well.
Yeah, no, I love, you know, I did a lot of theater. I love the process mm-hmm. of getting into a role. I love the homework that needs to be done. I like being a part of the master plan for a director versus stand-up, which is just solo mission. And, you know, you're the lone gunman out there, and mm-hmm. it's your ideas. And I love that it's completely it's a collaborative effort. It's everything about it. It's fucking morning instead of night.
Right.
You know, you have to be there at 5 a.m. But I really think that when I saw Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting, mm-hmm. that was kind of another moment for me where I was like, it's okay to say I want to do something that's meaningful. I want to do something that's really moving. That's and just, again, allowing yourself to not put a limitation and say, all right, if a role comes along. Now, when Mr. Brooks came along, I was doing a movie in Albuquerque, and I heard about Brooks, and Kevin Costner only knew me as a stand-up. He'd seen me do a couple shows. Yeah. Always very friendly, nice. never buddies or anything, just friendly.
By the way, that's a cool thing in itself to get to a level to where people that you've grown up watching are now like being like, hey, I'm a fan of you, right?
Like, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's like Field of Dreams, being from Boston.
Sure, dude, that's...
Yeah.
There's probably a slew of those people that are now like, you know...
Yeah, a lot, you know, Suzanne Summers.
did she give you a free thigh master?
I put myself on tape, actually, for Mr. Brooks.
Great move.
Sent it from my trailer. I was in between mm-hmm. scenes shooting Employee of the Month in Albuquerque. Sent the tape to my agent, who brought it to Costner's house personally and was like, you should watch this. And I got it off tape. So, again, if he hadn't seen my stand-up, he might not have, and he was like, oh, Dane's always, you know, invited us out, really pleasant, good guy. I'll take 2 minutes and watch this tape. Mm-hmm. And two turns into whatever, 7-minute tape, and he's like,
shit,
give him the role.
Shit.
So it really, everything is about, if any young comics are listening, just feed the stand-up.
Our demo is 95-year-old women.
Feed if there's any nursing homes.
Put down that applesauce.
With pureed meats. No, it really is. It's you don't worry so much about all the other, you know, ancillary things of like, I need this person on my team. Mm-hmm. No. All you need to do is consistently get better and better on stage and find your voice, your fans, and all those other people will eventually
come to you. Yeah. And the thing is that's the part that you can control. You can control your stand up. You can't control what these people see you.
It's
or
a
talk
tough thing to grasp,
like
though,
that.
Man. Because especially out here in LA, where I just see, you know, I mean, even, you know, because I pretty much started out here only a few open mics in Seattle before I came down. But I see even young comics now, a couple years in, that are just can't grasp that, like, because they're just too. Why is it you think people are so concerned with like, I got to get on that festival thing or I got to get this because that'll let me know that I'm.
Yeah, it's self validation. Yeah. You know, it's a lot of it's fear. If I'm not on that, what am I not going to get if I'm not on that?
Was Dane Cook on Comedy Central doing the Monopoly bit in the tank
top? Is this
top?
Another Dane Cook that we're speaking of? Yep. You're on a first name basis with every fucking person that isn't in the room. I'm sitting right here, and you call me Dane Cook to my face. Wow. First of all, it's Dr. Dane Cook. And secondly,
an honorary doctorate, you asshole.
But like,
does Dane Cook enjoy Honey Smacks in the morning? Or is he a Fruit Loop guy?
Well, does he? What is your cereal? What is your go-to cereal? That's a great question.
That's Fruit Loop. I'm a Fruit Loop guy. It's pretty much all I do.
Is Fruit Loop it up?
Yeah, that's it.
Something about Toucan
Sam. I'm not really a cereal guy, but if I'm going to do cereal, I go Fruit Loop.
What's your go-to snack then?
I'm not too big on snacks or chips. Ugh, I don't know. This is where we hit the fucking
abort button.
This is
the wall here. This is like towards the end of Inside the Actor's Studio. And James, if you got to heaven and God said, "What's your favorite snack?" What would you tell him? Would you give him a Sufi?
If you were a Girl Scout cookie, which one would you be and why?
That is a great question.
And mint.
Got to. That's an easy one.
I don't know if it was the delivery or the fucking just like the fucking eye glaze over.
Hey, you had thought about that. Well, Dane, the fact that you are on this podcast, first of all, thank you. That you invite us into your home.
Let's talk about
thank
payment.
You for that.
Well, Brad,
all right,
Brad.
Zip. Oh,
zip.
Wait a second.
Jesus. I just really want to ask this real quick before we wrap this up, because you did mention
Nine
the
Inches.
Well, there you go.
Thanks for being on the podcast,
yep, man.
you mentioned your theater background and singing, and then you fucking did the producers of the Hollywood Bowl.
That was pretty wild.
Yeah.
Mel Brooks.
You got to talk about that because I came from a musical theater background, so the fact you got to do that is
I was
bananas.
The song and dance man. I was doing Cole Porter plays back in high school, summer stock, all that. Anything Goes. I was
anything
Billy
goes.
Crocker. And
I wasn't Anything Goes.
Were you really?
Yeah. I was one of the – I wasn't a main part. I was just one of the sea captains or whatever.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah.
Great play.
Had to fucking learn how to tap dance.
Yeah. Holy yeah. Shit. No. It was,
where's that video?
I can still tap dance.
What?
Yeah.
You want to just show them real quick? Little...
I can shuffle off to Buffalo with the best of them. You don't know. You don't know. My time step is legendary.
Shuffle. Is that something from the play, or did you just make up that sound?
Do me a favor. Step ball change right under my balls.
I want that sound bite, by the way. Anytime my mom calls, I want that to ring.
Susan Stroman, who was directing it, you know, the incredible Susan Stroman, she asked me to come down. There, she had heard from somebody that I could hold a tune, and I went in with all the songs that Franz Liebkin in the play sings. Mm-hmm. And I worked on the German accent, like, just gave it everything I had. And Susan was like, "I'm going to send this to Mel." So Mel Brooks took a listen. And
holy
then
shit,
I was in the,
man.
In the play.
Mel Brooks.
And he came down. He was
I thought I was name dropping with Cherry from fucking Punky Brewster.
It was
so
amazing,
wait, Mel
though.
Came down. And
yeah,
watched.
Mel was there, obviously, for a couple of days. And then during the curtain calls on the first and last night, came out. I got a picture with him, give me a kiss on the cheek. And just,
God, dude.
Yeah, Mel, that's actually been one of the coolest things in my whole career has been getting to know some of these guys that Jerry Lewis I became good friends with over the last year, and he's just been kind of like a mentor, and he's just he's one of the best, not just because of what he accomplished in terms of like performance, but he's just a very smart innovative man. And so it's being able to meet the guys that already did it, already had all the good, all the bad, and are living consistent, like, creative lifestyles.
Yeah, I was
going to
ask,
oh,
are
that's
they?
What I want to do.
Are they, like, is he in a place where he's just super reflective about everything, or is it like, those were the good old days, like, move on?
No, it's amazing. I mean, they can be like that, but they're also just so present. That's the thing, is they're so kind of Zen and Yoda about it that, Jerry is doing a drama. He's 87. He's been in the industry for 85 years.
He's insane.
He's 87.
Yeah.
He's been in the industry. I asked him one day. He was like, "How long?" He goes, 85 years. It's like 85
dude,
years.
That's got to be the record, right? I mean,
it's something.
It's
like,
I mean,
it's like him and Betty
maybe
White.
Maybe George
are going
Burns
for
before
it.
He passed, because I don't know how young he started. But so you talk to these guys, and what they really, Phyllis Diller or people I've met over the years, what you really, even Rodney, what you just get from most of them is just don't sweat the small stuff. Everything is going to happen to you. People are going to die. People are going to steal. People are going to fucking say you did A, B, and C when you didn't. People are going to say you did D, E, and F, and you did. and you got to own the shit you did, and you got to fucking fight against, either fight against or don't speak to the things that aren't of you, because then you're just inviting it in, and you're also like, it's the politician thing. You can't fight lies. When you do, you look like a person who lied.
Right. Wow.
So that's all the stuff that I've taken over the years from people that are way, way, way further along than we are and kind of make us look like we're just a ragtag bunch of kids here. Right. But it's, you know, it is a marathon, not a sprint. So hopefully we're sitting here talking about this stuff in 50 fucking years from now and going like, oh, yeah, remember we thought we knew it all back in 2013.
So if somebody, we will meet back at this spot in 50 years and do another podcast.
So if somebody gives Brad shit for saying like, oh, you didn't fucking step ball change under his fucking nuts, I guess you can't do it, he shouldn't go after them.
Well, I'm sure Brad will have passed away by then, but we'll be here, Adam. Look at us. We're healthy.
I got a very weak heart. A very weak heart.
Did all your theater experience, though, help for the Hollywood Bowl? I mean, like...
Yeah, all of it.
And for stand-up, too, I want to ask that, because I feel like...
Who said that once? Like, some performer who... it just came to me. Johnny Carson. Great, great, great interview, Johnny Carson.
Yeah, he told Martin this, too, right? Like, you will use everything you ever
learned.
Yeah.
He said that. He goes, you use everything. You use the games that you played when you were a little kid. You use Jesus. The sadness from, you know, at
losing
a funeral.
A slip and slide,
you
yeah.
use everything. Yeah. And it's really true. And by the way, that Johnny Carson interview is a must-listen for any young comics. It's I got to get the name. We could probably put it on your
yeah.
podcast.
Yep,
but
sure.
It's March 18th, 1967, and he sat down and did an Shit. Interview with, and it's escaping me, but it's so prolific, and it's about now. He speaks about comedy and comics like we are now, but he's just using Jack Benny and other right. other names. So if you do a little bit of research, suss it out a bit, mm-hmm. you know the style of the guys and how they kind of relate to who we are, mm-hmm. and it's an amazing interview, Johnny Carson, talking about what it is to be. He talks about ego. He talks about looks. He talks about what we talked about. Like, you know, the interviewer's like, Johnny, does it help that the crowd finally knows who you are once
Same
you've established
yeah.
yourself? So it's just everything we're talking about, but he's actually much more, you know, kind of detailed in his descriptions of what it is to really be at a high level, high caliber performer, I guess.
Well, he fucking was.
He knew. Was the master.
I mean, yeah.
He was Johnny.
Yeah.
Did he sing at the Hollywood Bowl and the producers? No, he did not.
He did not. Maybe he did, actually.
Maybe
that
he
guy did a lot
maybe.
Of shit.
Yeah, he could have. He might have done Into the Woods.
But yeah, everything that I, you know, just everything from playing large crowds, everything from, you know, singing early in my life and then sometimes singing, you know, maybe with like Newberg or
yeah.
bringing guitar. Like,
yeah.
I was prepared for that moment and went into it like I try to with most things, which is once you have the gig, there's no need to be afraid anymore. You got it.
Even all that stuff has prepared you to be the voice of a fucking cartoon. I mean, yeah, in a strange way.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up loving Disney, loving animation. Once the Pixar movies came, Incredibles is probably in my top 10 favorite movies of all time.
Great film.
John Lasseter I've known for many, many years, and it was just a lucky night at the Hollywood Bowl, as a matter of fact, that I went to see an evening of Pixar music.
I was going to ask. I want to see that so
shit.
Bad.
Yeah,
is
I went
it,
down.
It
was
unreal.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It was amazing. The L.A. Philharmonic Orchestra played. And
now, how did you – I mean, and you had no idea that it was going to be the voice of a plane. What if he was like – he left a message. He's like, look, Dane, I got this fucking whole story around a black dildo, and I want you to be the voice of
You're
a black
dildo. You're
the
first talking vagina in the history of animation.
Pixar's going a little different direction.
You're Clitty the talking vagina.
Wow. I think we should end on Clitty
yeah,
the talking vagina.
I think
vagina.
So,
man.
That's a high point.
No, but when he, honestly, we just, you know, we finished the film and it came out this last weekend and it's doing great. We already finished a sequel. And so now to be wow. part of like.
Franchise.
Yeah, franchise. And this is all I've ever wanted to do. I've always wanted to be affiliated with people that I can look to and learn from. And so it doesn't feel like – I love being at the helm of my own brand and my own business, mm-hmm. but I love then kind of giving that away and being under the tutelage
sure.
of somebody like John
yeah,
Lasseter
sure.
where you go into a room and you go – it's what we talked about before. You're the new guy in the room, and you just want to win. And so to go into a sound booth and be like, I got to show him what I can do.
Wow.
It's the old stuff that we want in our yeah. stand-up. And you know what? It goes right back into the stand-up. Because when I took the stage and have been, because of that experience, it's the same jolt, and then it all comes back and informs your persona on stage. So it just all goes back into the mix, man.
So you feel very fortunate to get those experiences that put you out of your comfort zone for a little bit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because then it becomes being out of your comfort zone becomes the comfort zone.
Wow. That's a fortune cookie thing,
right
there.
In your comfort zone is I'm petrifying, literally turning to stone.
By the way, that's
I'm learning shit.
That's Clitty the Vagina's message, by the
way. Clitty says that in the sequel.
Clitty says that in the sequel. Says that to Peter the fucking penis shit.
Squirtily do!
That's the catchphrase.
That's what happens when you squeeze the Clitty the Vagina dolls.
Squirtily do!
Squirtily doo da!
Is that the second string pull or is that also the first
time?
One?
Yeah, every time.
It's work in progress. You get multiple catchphrases.
Dane, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, bro.
Did you have a good time?
Absolutely.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. Get the fuck out of my house.
we will get the fuck out of your house.
No, this was really great. And thanks for inviting me on to the About Last Night podcast.
Yeah, dude, I mean, this is a
we're going to do it again in 50 years.
50 years.
But
can't
Brad
wait
will be
without
dead.
Brad.
But I'll be dead.
We'll replace him with the guy from Willow.
We're going to pre-record Brad's...
What's his name? Lark Voorhees?
What?
Oh, no, that's from
Warwick
Saved by the
Davis.
Bell. Warwick Davis.
Yeah.
Well, he's like 40 years older than me, asshole. He'll be dead, too.
Yeah, but he knows Mad Mardigan.
Oh, that's true.
We can't end on Brad being dead.
We can't.
Let's right. kill Adam somehow. No, this was really great.
Give me another Clitty catchphrase to go out on, please.
Oh, man, what else would Clitty say?
That's the spot.
We're in a predicament. It sure is smelly down here.
That's what you will take
That's
from
a
this episode.
Bull story. Squiggly do. Squirtly IA.
Oh, God. Thank you for listening, Dane. Thank you for being here. For Adam Ray, Dane Cook, I'm Brad Williams. Please try to remember our names in the morning.
Squirtly do.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny and I love you.